This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his instruction on the general letters. This is session number 23, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 20 through chapter 5, verse 14. Admonitions to leadership and community at large.
Hi, welcome back. My name is Herb Bateman, and we're finishing up our study of the book of 1 Peter. We divided this book, as I've said in the past, into three sections, really. A section that dealt with salvation and the implications and response to salvation, and that ran from 1:1 to 2:10. Then we spent some time on living godly lives in society, which focused on 2:11 to 3:12. And then we moved into a section that I've labeled admonitions. But the admonition section is actually three parts. We looked at the first of the first section, which was the longest group of admonitions, when it dealt with admonitions concerning our response to suffering. This video, what we want to do is look at Peter's admonition to leadership, leaders in the church, and then the section of admonitions to the community at large and their responses. And then finally, we're going to deal with and wrap it up with the closing salutation in 1 Peter. But before I begin thinking about and talking about leadership in 1 Peter, one of the things that I always admire about leaders, and I've already mentioned this in our last segment concerning suffering, where Jesus is set up as the example to follow when it comes to suffering, and rightfully so, because he suffered for something he didn't do, and was murdered for it. He was crucified for it. But yet, at the end of the day, he was deemed victorious for it. I admire films that focus on sacrificial leadership like that. One of my favorite is Glory, with Matthew Broderick in it. And it's a set in the Civil War era, and he is Matthew Broderick plays the part of Colonel Robert Gould Shore from Massachusetts, and he's given the leadership role, the responsibility to lead a group of African Americans, to train them up so that they can fight in the Civil War for the North. And there's numerous segments of the story that are they tug at your heart. The lack of understanding on Shaw's part concerning what a black slave had gone through. And there's a lack of understanding on the black or the African American, and some of the attitudes that pretty much come through on from Danielle Washington, who plays an African American soldier in that regiment. But the gripping part that that just inspires me is at the end of the film, when they're pinned down and they're trying to take Sumter on or a fort on Carolina's shores, and the regiment volunteered to lead an attack against this rebel fort, the southern fort on the Carolina shore, and they get pinned down. I mean, their entire regiment gets pinned down, and it's looking pretty bleak. But to spur his men on, he picks up his sword, stands up, and leads a charge. And his men followed. A good leader doesn't ask you to do something that he or she is not willing to do themselves. I think that applies to leadership in a local church. And I think Peter is admonishes leaders, elders, concerning their role as leaders in a church. So this is an admonition to leaders. Christians, followers of Jesus, they need pastoral care. Humility, spiritual alertness, and God's gracious help in the midst of suffering for their faith. And so as we think about leaders in general, pastoral care, humility, spiritual alertness, grace, graciousness, these are all attributes of a leader that Peter wants to drive home. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the first four verses because it deals with elders and the how it is that an elder is to provide pastoral care and leadership for the suffering flock. So as your fellow elder and a witness of Christ's suffering, and as one who shares in the glory that will be revealed, I urge the elders among you, give a shepherd's care to God's flock among you, exercising oversight not merely as a duty, but willingly under God's direction, not for shameful profit, but eagerly. And do not lord it over those entrusted to you, but be examples to the flock. Then when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that never fades away. So in light of the inevitability that trials appear, Peter gives a special charge to the leaders of the church, the elders of the church. And he himself was an elder. He speaks from experience. He participated in the sufferings that come along with being a follower of Jesus. And the idea of witness doesn't mean observed and just merely of Christ's sufferings, but that he shared in the sufferings of Jesus. He knew what it meant to suffer. So we have this as a fellow elder. Peter is recognizing, I'm like you guys. I'm an elder just like you. And I've witnessed and experiencing sufferings that some of you are experiencing. And then he talks about what it means to be a shepherd of God's flock that are under your care. It's overseeing them. You shepherd your flock by watching over them. It's not by compulsion, but it's willingly. You watch over people. You care for the people in your church because you care for them. And it's not for greed of money, but with eager enthusiasm. I think one of the words here, give a shepherd's care to God's flock among you, exercising oversight, not merely as a duty, but willingly under God's direction, not for shameful profit, but eagerly. there is a sense that leading and guiding has the idea of guarding. We need to be mindful and guard those we watch over, and providing the need for those in the church. I think, you know, we live in a period of time, and I've said this on more than one occasions in churches that I have served in and have served as an elder. We live in a period of time where we overcommit as leaders to the point that we don't have time to do these expectations well. Oftentimes, as an elder, you may find yourself doing 2-3 things within the church, 3 activities that are very time-consuming and demanding. In addition to working a 40, 50, maybe even a 60-hour week, taking care of the family, running the kids from this event to the other event. And we struggle with being a shepherd that exercises oversight, not merely as a duty. It tends to be more of a duty when we're overcommitted rather than something that's willingly being practiced. And don't lord it over those entrusted to you. In thinking about leadership styles, there's all different types of leadership style. But the minute I hear someone say, "I'm a benevolent dictator," that is not a First Peter elder. Do not lord it over them. Do not overlord those entrusted to you. Instead, be an example to the flock. A benevolent dictator is all about self, and that's a poor example as to what type of a leader an elder is to be. Then when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that never fades away. Now I'm going to use an illustration that is a stretch. But I think it exemplifies the care, the concern for another person. It's manifested in a movie, and this illustration can be used for a number of different opportunities: sacrifice, the right perspective about what grace is. There's a number of things that this flick could represent. I'm going to use it to represent what good leadership is. It's set in World War II. It's a movie that is who has its background. It's setting in World War II. And women are sitting around keeping tabs on who is dying, who is missing in action, and who to send letters to. And within this one office, it's quickly determined that 3 brothers have all been killed, and there's only one son that remains for this family. And so the order goes out to save Private Ryan. Some general over his forces cared enough, not just for that young man, but for the family of 4 men over whom he is over control with, sets out an order to save Private Ryan. And then if you're familiar with the flick, you know how these eight men, the struggle that they're going through, it's a suicide mission in many ways, going behind enemy lines to try to rescue this young man, Private Ryan. By the way, this is a true story. And all but one, I think, if I remember the storyline, are killed. They lose their lives. But Private Ryan is saved and is returned home to his family. That's watching over the people under your leadership. That's caring for the men and women that are serving under you. And that's happening by the federal government. If they can do it, we should be able to do it better. What is your concern for the people in your flock? To what lengths will you go to save a Private Ryan or a member in your congregation to come alongside, to guard, to protect, to keep them, to help them succeed in their walk for Jesus? Are we overcommitted? Elders are to provide pastoral care and leadership for a suffering flock. The next thing author does is he talks to all Christians and how all Christians, all believers, all followers of Jesus are to submit to God's sovereign control and fatherly care. We read in verses 5 through 7, "In the same way, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. And all of you, clothe yourself with humility toward one another." Why? Because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And God will exalt you in due time if you humble yourselves under his mighty hand by casting all your cares on him. Why? For this very simple reason, he cares about you. So likewise, young men are to be submissive to the elders. And even though this, many of your translations may say young men, I think a better rendering here of this Greek term would be young people or younger people. During the time of the New Testament, congregations were seen as older and younger as far as age was concerned, the older generation and the younger generation. The recognition that there is a difference between a young person and their maturity level and capabilities versus an older person and the wisdom that comes with age and just life experiences. And so Peter is recognizing this very much in keeping with society, his Greco-Roman society, and he's expressing to the young people in the congregation to be subject to the elders. And all of you, clothe yourself with humility towards one another. And this idea of clothing with humility, like using humility as a garment, this word in the Greek for clothe, it's very rare. It's a rare one that comes from a word referring to the apron slaves put on over their regular clothes that prepare them for service. So the idea is humility is sort of like given a it's like becomes a metaphor for clothing. Put it on as you prepare yourself to serve within the church, as you serve within community. Put on, like clothing, humility. It has to be deliberate. It has to be an act that you do. Humility doesn't come naturally. It's very easy to become very proudful. But here Peter says, as you serve, put on, make a deliberate effort and put on humility as you serve. Because God opposes the proud. We serve God humbly, not in arrogance. We serve God humbly, not with proud for spirits. We serve God humbly, not as boastful servants. So this, the idea is, don't let it go to your head. God has gifted us. We're to use our gifts. We're to serve in the church. But be humble in your service. And in due time, God will exalt us. But it's conditioned upon our being humble. And then there's this expectation, this admonition to, as you're suffering, as you're going through things, you're going through life, and you may experience a situation that is extremely painful, we're to strive to be humble in situations by casting our cares on Him, because He does care for us. In much the same way as elders are being asked to care for the flock, it's being communicated to us that God cares for us. Once again, we're right back. God is not asking us to do anything that He Himself doesn't do when it comes to the way He relates and cares for His people and those that are in the community of believers. Now, from here, he moves to another characteristic. Another admonition about the community, and it's an admonition to be self-controlled and alert in spiritual warfare. This shows up in verses 8 and 9, and it is an exhortation that he gives. Be sober, be alert, and even though a connector expressing reason isn't there, he provides the reason. Your enemy, the devil, like a roaring lion, is on the prowl looking for someone to devour. Resist him. Strong in your faith, because you know that your brothers and sisters throughout the world are enduring the same kinds of suffering. So we have this expectation, this exhortation. Be self-controlled. Be alert. It kind of reminds me of, don't be surprised if you're mocked. Don't be surprised if you're being attacked. Be alert. Be mindful of this. Be self-controlled. Trust in God is not all that we need. We have to trust God. It's not a matter of trusting God and getting. It's not a matter of trust God and let go. It's trust God, and then here's what my responsibility is as I trust God. As I'm trusting God for protection, I need to be wise. I need to be self-controlled. I need to be alert. I need to be aware of what's happening around me so I don't do stupid stuff. Because I have an enemy that would love to see me fall. I have an enemy that would love to see me trip up. We need to be kept alert because there are people on the prowl that want to hurt us. And Satan uses people to hurt us. Peter's readers were in danger of being destroyed. And it's not like Satan was sending his evil hordes of evil spirits. He was just working with the people of the day. Satan continues to work with people of the day to strive to thwart God and thwart those who follow him. So Peter's readers were in danger of being destroyed, and they need to give their attention to being self-controlled in the midst of a bad situation and be alert. We are to resist the devil and the means that he uses to try to trip us up. But One of the things that's good is that we have on our side someone who can overcome evil. Resist him. Be strong in your faith, because you know that brothers and sisters throughout the world are enduring the same kinds of suffering. And once again, we're back into this Elijah mentality, a story that I shared earlier. It's not like we say, oh, God, I'm the only one suffering. You remember Elijah? Oh, God, I'm the only one that has bowed my knee to Baal. We are not the only ones who suffer for our faith. In fact, here in the United States, our suffering is nothing compared to others, Christians who may be in other countries, striving to be followers of Jesus, Muslim countries or China, we have no idea the type of sufferings that other people go through. Our sufferings are minuscule compared to some of the sufferings that others have gone through. We aren't alone. We've been told as we follow Jesus, we're going to follow a path of suffering. Some of us are going to suffer worse than others. But we're not alone. Then Peter moves into talking about how Christians are to draw their strength, to draw their courage, to draw their hope from God in the process of living for him. Verses 9 and 10, or 10 and 11 read, "And after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ," that is Christ Jesus, "will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. To him belongs the power forever. Amen." So whereas we're supposed to forsake the world and flee the lusts of the flesh and all that go with being a follower of Jesus, in verse 9, to resist, in verse 10, we have on our side one who is able to overcome our adversary. He is able to give us grace. He is sufficient in his grace. And he's called us to experience the eternal glory that belongs to him, and he shares that with us. And it's to him, it is to God that belongs the power for all eternity. So we see in these in this group of admonitions, we see admonitions that are given by Peter, beginning in 4:13. Talking about admonitions about suffering. And he goes through several types of admonitions, several types of sufferings admonitions that we are to endure sufferings. Then he moves to admonitions about elders. And then finally, admonitions that are to the community at large. Which brings us to the epilogue, the closing of the letter. Now, as I've mentioned in the past, all letters had three parts to it. Generally, there's the salutation, the body, and the closing salutation. And when we looked at the opening salutation in Peter, we saw something that was very typical, where Peter identifies himself as a sender, where his recipients are clearly identified as those who are elect or chosen, living in Pontus, Galatia, and those areas in northern Galatia, Asia, and then a greeting. Then we looked at the body of the letter. Now we're going to look at the closing of the letter, and this is verses 12 through 14. And here the Apostle Peter concludes his letter with a summary. It's a summary statement. And then he gives some final greetings, and then a request and a benediction. So let's look at verse 12, where we have a summary statement. "Through Silvanus, whom I know to be a faithful brother, I have written to you briefly in order to encourage you and testify that this is the true grace of God. So Silvanus is a Latinized form of the Greek word Silas. Whether or not they are the same individual, we don't know. You remember Silas? Silas went to Paul with Paul on his second missionary journey. Barnabas took Mark on his second missionary journey. And if you remember, Paul and Barnabas had a dispute concerning Mark. And the dispute about Mark was over the fact that during the first missionary journey, when Paul, Barnabas, and Mark were sent out by the church in Antioch, he left. He left them to go back to Antioch, to go back home. And so as Paul and Barnabas are preparing their second missionary journey, Barnabas wants to take Mark with him. And Paul says, there's no way we're taking him with us. He deserted us last time. I am not going to put my neck out for this guy again. No. And so they got into a dispute to where they decided to part ways, to agree to disagree. And Paul took Silas and went to southern Galatia and revisited the churches that he had visited on the first trip. And Barnabas took Mark and went to Cyprus. And he visited the churches in Cyprus that both Paul, Barnabas, and Mark had visited. We do not know if Silas of that second missionary journey is the same Silas named here as Silvanus, is the same person. It is possible that he was an amanuensis for the writing of 1 Peter. Now, we spoke about this when we talked about genres in my book on interpreting the general letters. I have a section in here on the genre or the genre of the general letters. And we talked about the fact that not everyone could write in the ancient Near East. Not everyone could read in the Greco-Roman world. At most, 20% of the population in the Greco-Roman world could read and write. So people were trained to be letter writers. And if you wanted a letter to be written, you would hire an amanuensis. It is suggested that Silvanus is an amanuensis who assisted Peter in writing or composing the letter. I happen to believe that Peter didn't know how to write. He might be able to, you know, read a little bit and copy letters and copy numbers as a fisherman to keep books. But I think he was a fisherman, and I don't think education was part of his background. And I think in much the same way as the rest of the Greco-Roman world, he presented to this amanuensis a letter he wished to write, and the amanuensis helped him write the letter, and he penned the letter for him. Remember that it is not unusual. I mean, just think about Paul. Paul was an educated person. Paul was able to read. Paul was able to write, and yet he would hire an amanuensis. Why, Paul? Well, that's just what people did in those days. In much the same way, and I used this illustration when we talked about this under the genre of letter writing, we can write our own wills today. We can go online and get a template for wills. But most of us, we're going to hire an attorney. Why? Because they've been trained to write wills, and we have not. We might be able to read, we may be able to write, but the attorney has the legalese to be able to do it right and to secure our belongings, to be able to pass them on to our loved ones or pass them on to a nonprofit organization or whatever we want to do with it. We hire an attorney in much the same way in the ancient Near East. You hired an amanuensis if you wanted a letter written. Now, very few occasions where amanuensis might not be used. So it is possible that Silvanus is both the amanuensis and the letter carrier for this letter to the churches scattered throughout that northern Galatia area. So Silvanus, whom I know to be a faithful brother, someone that Peter has a great deal of confidence in. We go to verse 12. I've written this briefly in order to encourage you with a specific intention. The intention for Peter to write this letter is to be encouraging. And you know, when you're down, when you're suffering, you need encouragement. You need someone to come alongside to recognize that you what it is you're going through, to identify your suffering, to empathize with your suffering, but yet to come alongside in such a way to affirm that you keep on keeping on. And then he says, stand fast in it. Stand fast in your suffering. Don't sway. And in some ways, this isn't too much different from Hebrews, although the author of Hebrews is a little bit more intense about his the manner in which he encourages people to keep their faith. Then he says, the church in Babylon, chosen together with you, greets you, and so does Mark, my son. Now, that's an interesting description. I thought, where is he writing this thing from? Babylon? Is he in Babylon? Babylon may just refer to, it may refer to the city of Babylon on the Euphrates River, but it seems more likely to be a veiled reference to Rome, where Peter spent the last days of his life. Remember, I see 1 Peter as being written somewhere in the early 60s, maybe 64, and he's in Rome. Babylon is known as a city of sin, idolatry, it becomes a personification for sin. And so Babylon is seen, Rome is depicted as being Babylon in a metaphorical sense. Why would Peter have called Rome Babylon? Well, probably he did so because Rome was the capital of the pagan world. At one time, Babylon was the capital of the pagan world. So he's recognizing and calling the place from which he's writing, Babylon. The church in Babylon, the church in Rome, chosen together with you, greets you. So he's recognizing not only are the people in Rome that are followers of Jesus chosen, but so are the people in Bithynia, Galatia, Asia, in this northern Galatia area. They are chosen. We have chosen people throughout the Greco-Roman world, Peter is acknowledging as he closes out this letter. Notice who's with him. Mark. That same dude that decided not to stick around for that first missionary journey, and Barnabas encouraged him, and they went out on the second one. And of course, now we see Mark in Rome with Peter. I happen to believe that St. Mark is the Mark that wrote the Gospel of Mark. Perhaps these two writings are coming together. Peter and Mark are collaborating together, and Peter is preaching, and Mark is writing this down, and he's putting together this letter. Who knows? But we do see Peter and Mark together in Rome, and as this letter closes, he says, greet one another with loving kiss. Peace to all of you who are in Christ. So as we close out this letter, as we close Peter, our study of Peter, Peter is writing to a group of people that are suffering at the hands of the culture in which they find themselves. And Peter is encouraging them to hang strong. First, Peter is encouraging them that to remember that God isn't asking you to do anything that he himself hasn't gone through. And that's a sign of a good leader. That's a sign of a God who cares. That's a sign of God who's willing to put his neck out because and not willing to ask us to do things that he himself isn't willing to do. So with that, I'm going to close. I do have 10 minutes left. I think what I'll do is talk a little bit about 2 Peter, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about 2 Peter. But let me just do a follow-up a little here. I think 2 Peter was written towards the end of Peter's life. You could be as early as 66, perhaps as late as 68. So I do see 2 Peter as being written around just shortly after the writing of 1 Peter by maybe 2 or 4 years, if 1 Peter is written in 64. Once again, there are places you can go to evaluate some of these discussions about 1 Peter. Carson's book on the Introduction to the New Testament, L. Wells and Yarborough's book on the Encounter, the New Testament series that I think Zondervan puts out. You can go to those two places and talk about the discussions concerning the date of the book. I do think that some of these writings and the sufferings that may be going on may have some connection with the revolt that's going on in Judah. I don't have, I can't, definitively say one way or the other. I do think the Hebrews, the Jewish people in Rome, may be feeling some residual effects of the Jewish revolt and Rome's dissatisfaction with that revolt. How that revolt might have an impact on people in Bithynia, I don't know. That might be stretching it. But as we go to look at 2 Peter, he's dealing with different issues in 2 Peter. Here, 1 Peter, he's concerned about suffering. And just like the Messianic Son of Promise suffered, we suffer. But in 2 Peter, he's going to be dealing with false teaching. So we're going to spend a little time on false teachers as we think our way through 2 Peter. So that'll be next time as we approach our study in 2 Peter. But in the meantime, I trust that you will walk with the King and that you will be a blessing to all those that you come in contact with. Bye.
This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his instruction on the general letters. This is session number 23, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 20 through chapter 5, verse 14, admonitions to leadership and community at large.